Welcome to Dr. Emmett Miller's Healing Times Radio, Conversations with Extraordinary People. This show can be heard on Dream Vision 7 Radio Network every Friday at 1 p.m. and 1 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, 10 a.m. and 10 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Go to dreamvision7radio.com, click Listen Live, and enjoy the show.
Hello, this is Dr. Emmett Miller. Welcome back to Conversations with Extraordinary People. Here, our goals are to look beyond the superficial, to encounter the essence of the human experience, to explore new and creative ways of meeting life's obstacles, challenges, and opportunities successfully. Our purpose is to discover new and powerful ways of healing, balancing, and optimizing the function of mind, body, emotion, behavior, and spirit. And at this time in history, we desperately need to heal and transform at both the individual and the collective level. In each episode, we bring you intelligent conversations with the movers and shapers who have created the new medicine and other holistic approaches and integrative approaches, especially to individual and collective healing, and people who are still contributing their wisdom and practical guidance. And today I have a very special guest with you who is definitely one of the movers and shapers of this world we live in now as concerns how we think about our health and about our wellness. It's Jack Travis. Jack Travis had the first ever wellness center right here in California in Mill Valley. And I met him back fairly soon after he had opened that center, so it was in the early 70s. And before I share this interview with you, and the interview is a while ago, but I think you'll find it really interesting. Jack, his approach of wellness fit very much with the approach that I had been developing to medicine and healthcare back in the 60s and 70s. Because, as Jack pointed out, that the Western notion of what it was to be healthy at that time was basically you didn't have any symptoms, and if we did lab tests on you and all your values were within the normal range, then you were considered to be healthy and we didn't have anything else to do with you. And then if you began to, let's say, not take care of yourself or develop infection or some other illness, the first thing that would happen would be, if you were lucky enough to find it, we find your lab tests were off. You might not know that anything was going on, but we might say, hey, you've got a very high uric acid, and if you don't already have arthritis, you'll probably be developing it unless we do something about it. But often people don't have their condition discovered by a lab test, and so they continue to go downhill until the imbalance within their bodies becomes so great that it produces a symptom they become aware of. That could be a headache or a backache or a feeling of anxiety or confusion or dizziness, whatever it might be. And that's, let's say, further in the direction of illness. Then comes the full-on disease, not just the symptoms. And if that's not taken care of, you become very ill and at death's door, and finally you die. And so there's not like being healthy or being sick, but what Jack pointed out was that there's a spectrum. But he also pointed out that the spectrum doesn't just go to not having symptoms, but what if we go in the other direction? Let's say a person who's eating well, who's sleeping well, who's exercising well, and who's doing the right kinds of things in their life, then not only do they feel healthy, but they've got a reserve. And if they have to deal with a stress or a challenge, they're able to do that. They're able to keep themselves healthy. And even beyond that, if we see the person who's really in tip-top physical shape, who's emotionally really happy, who's mentally clear and right on, well, when we say this person is even more well. So we have this spectrum then that goes from extremely sick and almost dead past just not having any symptoms all the way up to high-level wellness. And that approach fit with mine because it took the sort of black and white of healthy and well and turned it into many shades of gray or a spectrum. And this is how I'd come to look at the world in the work that I was doing. And I just want to talk a little bit about that perspective, and then we'll go on and enjoy the interview with Jack. This is the same principle of a spectrum we see in some of the ancient teachings. Like if you look at yin and yang, they're black and they're white, but they're sort of squiggled together because the whole notion is you should find the middle way, a balance between black and white. And in the middle of the white yin, there's a black dot. And in the middle of the black yang, there's a white dot. There to signify that in everything is the seed of its apparent opposite. Now, what's happened in our culture is because of how we've thought about the world really since René Descartes has been a dualistic way. It's made up of black or white, good or bad, me or you, good guy, bad guy, win, lose. And so we tend to see the world through a paradigm of thinking that thinks about things in that way. René Descartes said, "I think, therefore I am." What he really was saying was, "I doubt, therefore I am. The one thing I know that I can do is to doubt, and therefore I know that I exist." And he believed that you could know the world and through science, and that science was certain and evident, and that you could figure everything out. And his method was analytic, about breaking things into pieces. And that, of course, is one of the things that's wrong with our world in general, of how we're not all working together, but we're shattered into different pieces, and it's me or you, left or right wing, and so forth. And it turns out that the vast majority of our illnesses also are based upon conflicts that we're having within ourselves. Most of our unhappiness is based on those conflicts. Conflicts, I should be doing this, but I don't feel good enough, or somebody's picking on me, or I feel afraid of something that's out there, stage fright, or whatever it is. These beliefs that we have, in which we set the world up as good and bad, and then we're reacting to that good and bad, that creates the conflict inside, which creates the chemicals of stress, which cause the body to break down, which makes it much easier for any kind of disease to get started. And thus we make ourselves sick through our internal conflict, the same way the external conflict is making the world sick outside. And in the field of medicine, what I found was, we started into school, the first thing we were given was a dead body, a cadaver. It was ugly, it smelled really bad, and we were given a book and told to start carving into this body, and lab assistants would come along and help us, you know, tease out different nerves, and we actually lived with that dead body for the better part of a year, until we had dissected in detail every tiny little part of it. I began to think that suppose there is a different way of starting medical school, What if there had been a week of seeing movies of bodies functioning well and beautifully, people in love, people playing music? Maybe we'd focus on the flow of their hands as they played the violin, or really appreciate the well-sculpted body of a ballet star or something like that. What if we'd watched movies of really fine athletes or dancers, watched babies, people in love, and had a sense of what it was to really function at our highest, and then begin to look at what we could do to keep people healthy? Instead, we got this cadaver. There's one fellow who actually quit school that week. He could not deal with the shock of this ugly, smelly, dead body. And this is a guy who'd been through a pre-medical course at a very good school. He was very bright, or he wouldn't have been in Albert Einstein College of Medicine. But he quit medicine because of the shock. And we don't know who we're shocking when we do things in such coarse ways. But later on, I was to discover, when I started practicing hypnotherapy, that if a person just visualized an outcome, they were much more likely to reach that outcome, whether it was hitting a home run or if it was to heal up more rapidly. One young fellow I saw who had warts, and I had him visualize that there was a hose running through his body down to the warts, and just the way you can water plants and have them grow, but if you turn the water off, they die. We were going to turn the hose off, and that was going to make these warts die. That kid was about 11 years old, and he had seen what happens in his garden. And with a week, his warts just dropped off. Well, we know there's really no hose inside of his body, but he visualized a positive outcome, and some innate intelligence was able to act to do the things that needed to be done. Modern medicine can only guess at how it was that he was able to eliminate those warts. We'd say something with the immune system. But actually, there was something within that child. When he visualized the outcome he wanted, it set in motion a mechanism that was actually capable of bringing about that outcome. So this is what I saw with John's work. It focused on thinking about the good, not just focusing on the bad. And if you're familiar with the recent program that I recorded, called Sad to Glad, How to Overcome Stress, Anxiety, and Depression and Feel Happy Again. And on that program, what we aim to do is to show that there's a spectrum from very unhappy all the way up to very, very happy. And so wherever you are on that spectrum, you can start using these tools to move in the positive direction. And this whole notion really has to do with, let's say, accessing one's spirit, one's belief systems, one's spiritual system. And when we learn how to contact the spiritual level, I see us as having a physical level of behavior and activity, and then there's above that, there's an emotional level, because your emotions will determine a lot about what happens physically. And then above that is your thinking level, where your thoughts control your emotions, which then control your body. On top of that are the images. What are the fantasies that you're having in your mind? How do you imagine the world is being put together? Those images determine your thoughts and ultimately your physical health and well-being and success. But then, what determines the images and beliefs that are in your mind? That's a still higher level. I call that the spiritual level. Regardless of what you believe or don't believe, there is a spiritual level. It is causing things to happen in your life. And if you learn how to access that level and to work with it, then you can bring about not only health and healing, but also high-level wellness. Okay, here's the show with John. Enjoy.
Hello, this is Dr. Emmett Miller, and this is Healing Times Radio. Our guest this week is John W. Travis, MD, MPH. Jack Travis completed his medical degree in Boston and a residency in general preventive medicine at Johns Hopkins University. He subsequently founded the first wellness center in the U.S., the Wellness Resource Center, in Mill Valley, California, and that was in 1975. He's also founder and co-director of Wellness Associates, a not-for-profit educational foundation, and is also the author of the Wellness Inventory Online, which you can find at wellpeople.com. He's also the author of the Wellness Workbook, which you can find at thewellspring.com. During the 1980s and 1990s, along with his wife, Marin Callender, he focused on developing peer support networks among helping professionals, embracing a partnership model to offset the negative effects of the medical system's dominator model on its members. Realizing in 1991 that how we raise children has far more influence on their later wellness and the estrangement that leads to dominator systems than any other factors in our lives, he expanded the focus of his work to include infant wellness. Along with Marin and 11 world experts in birth and child development, he co-founded the Alliance for Transforming the Lives of Children, which can be found at atlc.org, and which fosters individual and planetary wellness through changing the norms of how babies are born and treated in their early years. Presently, they are authoring a book, Why Men Leave: The Epidemic of Disappearing Dads, which was first published as a magazine article. He, Marin, and their daughter, Sienna, now live in northern New South Wales, Australia. I've known Jack for 31 years now, and I've known him as a man who's both brilliant and eccentric. And in my experience, most people who have mapped out new territories, who've walked new paths and come forth with really creative developments and inventions, they've all been eccentric, so it's a real compliment for me to call someone eccentric. I've also known him as a deeply compassionate and wise man, and I'm really thrilled to invite you to join us here in on Deep Healing and Healing Times Radio. So, Jack, welcome.
Thank you, Emmett. Yes, eccentricity is something we both know pretty well. I'm reminded of those times back in the 70s when you used to call me up and fake some weird person's voice and have me going for 30 seconds or so before I figured out it was you.
I've had you up to at least a minute and a half, I think.
Really? Yeah, I think so.
Well, because it was always interesting to see how you would deal with it, because you would always be ready for something interesting. Yeah. You know, most people, if you call up and they don't know who it is, they're, yes, who is it? Who? Who? Where'd you get this number? That sort of thing. No. But you're always game to say, okay, what kind of experience am I going to have here? So, today I thought we would explore some of the things that I know are fairly close to your heart, such as
the importance of one's personal journey in their professional or business and social life, that we would talk a little bit about that concept of wellness, which really it was you who brought the concept of wellness into my life with the wellness inventory and with your wellness center there in Mill Valley, that we would talk a little bit about the evolution and devolution of the concept of wellness, and then go on to talk a little bit about the importance of looking at the question of who am I and why, and through the whole thing to be aware of the importance of that underlying thread of connection and its importance to healing and wellness. So let's talk a little bit about personal journey, Jack.
Well, I found that that is the crucial factor in all of my journeys in wellness. If I don't look at my own personal interests or motives or the reason why I'm doing something, then it usually runs me rather than me being in charge. So I'm sure that if I had had a happy childhood and everything had been normal, I'd probably be an investment banker or who knows what. I certainly wouldn't have gone into wellness. Certainly wouldn't have gone into medicine. I was a doctor because my daddy was a doctor, and I wanted to be like my daddy when I grew up. So I think our personal journey is a big factor of who we are professionally and is with us in all of our work with clients, patients, our writings, speaking, whatever. And the more conscious we are of that personal journey, the better able we are to bring out the gift that is in our wounding. And we're all wounded. I think our culture has massive disconnection. People aren't even aware of the level of disconnection in our culture. It shows up in all sorts of ways, from chronic pain, diseases, you name it, and it boils down to connection is usually the problem. They're trying to reestablish the connection that was lost in their early childhood.
Mm-hmm. And interesting that the wounds that we receive can have two effects. For one thing, they may lead us in a positive direction, assuming that you're happier to have gone into wellness than into investment banking.
I'll never know.
So that it's really a two-edged sword, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And if we pay attention to our personal journey, it's so much value can come from it. From my own, throughout a lot of my youth, I was very resentful and very upset about the fact that I had a father who felt the best way to discipline me for having poor conduct scores from school was to take off my clothes and whip me until I had welts on my body with a thick leather belt, and I felt really victimized. And yet, later on, I came to realize that the incredible sensitivity that I have to the suffering of people that I work with really comes from the fact that that I know what it is to suffer, and I see people who are in health and helping professions who haven't felt pain, and they have a hard time really seeing when other people are feeling pain.
Mm-hmm.
How do you see it in your life?
Well, for me, I wasn't physically abused, but I was emotionally abused, in that my parents raised me according to the standards of the 40s, where children should be seen and not heard, and you sleep alone, and you're on a four-hour bottle schedule. Breastfeeding was anathema. All of the comforts that a mammalian infant is used to experiencing or designed to experience are pretty much denied to most of us raised in the 40s and 50s, and even so many today. And so that provides a disconnection basis that is central to our lives. Our lives are organized around trying to reestablish the connection that was lost.
Mm-hmm.
Hospital births, circumcision, any number of factors that disconnect babies from their mothers and ultimately the rest of their environment. So my wounding specifically was around emotions. There was only one person in my family allowed to express emotions, my mother, and so I learned to swallow them and hold them inside. So became very much a head person. Intellect was my key to escaping the discomfort of being in my body. I had a 60-some year out-of-body experience. Just now really learning to get back into my body, to feel feelings and to experience sensations. So it's been a long process along the way. I've, professionally been teaching what I need to learn and hopefully learning some of it along the way.
And you can see that even though your approach was, very intellectually oriented, at some level its goal was still to make that connection.
Yes, yeah. Most recently, as you mentioned, my interest is in the phenomenon of men leaving families after their first child is born, mm-hmm. and the phenomenon of male postpartum abandonment syndrome, which came out of my own personal experience of my first daughter, who was born when I was in medical training. I wasn't ready to be a father. It was the most painful experience of my life, but out of it, I figured out what this phenomenon is and eventually realized that all of my work in wellness boiled down to connection.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Male postpartum
Abandonment syndrome. Or MPAS, pronounced MPAS.
MPAS, oh, I see. And so, is that book due to come out soon?
No, we're still in the, with 120,000 books being published a year, we're not even sure the book format's the best way to go with it. Maybe a website, we're still in process with it, but mm-hmm. sooner or later it'll come out in some form.
And we'll see it there on your website?
There is a link to the magazine article that actually you have to email me to get it. It's not in the public site, but if you send an email to the website address, I can send it to anyone.
And what's the website address?
Thewellspring.com.
Thewellspring.com.
Info@ is the email contact. Uh-huh. But the other thing I wanted to say is I believe the currency of wellness is connection. Uh-huh. And as I look back on 30-some years of doing wellness, everything boiled down to either connection or lack of connection. Mm-hmm. From the wellness energy system, which was the central organizing feature of all my work in the wellness workbook of individual wellness, the forms of energy we take in from the environment around us, the oxygen we breathe, the food, the sensory stimuli and all the other stimuli, that's the input, and then the throughput in our how we process it in our body and the output of how we move our body, the feelings we feel, the thoughts we think, the communications, all the different ways that we transform energy. Every one of those, the common denominator is connection. It took me 20-some years to recognize that, mm-hmm. but it boils down to connection, and because of this massive disconnection that we can't see, but people in other cultures can see it, mm-hmm. it's obvious to them how disconnected we are, and as a result, we're looking for ways to reestablish that connection, many of them not to our benefit. I think the whole DSM list of diseases is a categorization of attachment disorders and the different creative ways that human bodies and minds find to try to reestablish connection. But the underlying issue is failed connection and an attempt or a bid to create that connection again.
Mm-hmm. So, and of course, the DSM you're talking about is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual that, as I remember when I started practicing medicine, was about 50 pages long, and now it's about 450 pages long.
At least.
Invented more and more names of more and more illnesses, and you're saying they pretty much come down to an attachment disorder.
Yeah. And the drug companies are now inventing diseases so they can sell new drugs to it.
Uh-huh.
Treat them.
Uh-huh. Wow. So where did the term wellness come from?
It actually is a word in the English language dating back to the 1600s. but it hasn't gotten much play until Halbert Dunn, a physician who was also the head of the Bureau of Statistics for the U.S. government in the 30s, he set that up until his retirement in the 50s when he took an interest in wellness, gave a series of radio talks around Washington, D.C. on high-level wellness. He coined the term high-level wellness. It was published as a book in 1961, and I found it on the clearance table for $2 at the at the Johns Hopkins Medical Bookstore when I was a resident.
Huh.
Best $2 I ever spent.
Wow.
I thought the word wellness was kind of stupid and it wouldn't ever catch on, but his putting together the physical, mental, and spiritual dimensions in a way I'd never seen before. This is 1972, remember?
Mm-hmm.
There was almost no literature on any of the kind of growth and personal improvement stuff that litter the bookshelves now. And so I set out to start a wellness center and did so in 1975. I still thought it was a stupid word and it wouldn't catch on. But thanks to Don Ardell, who had also, he was one of the dozen people that had read the book, he started giving talks about it and eventually wrote a book about it. And my wife read that book when she was still a social worker in Melbourne, Australia. This is around the time that we met Emmett, and she came to our last seminar before we closed the center and and never left. So that's how the word got picked up. It was Ardell's tenacity of putting it out there. But then what happened in the 80s is that the hospitals, there were 1,000 hospital wellness centers in the early 80s. They all closed because they, like we, found out you can't make money on wellness. Insurance doesn't cover it, and it's a nice idea, but people aren't willing to pay for it. So it devolved into a medicalized version, and the term now for most people means getting your cholesterol checked, maybe doing some stress reduction, eating right, that sort of thing, which is really just early disease detection or prevention. It doesn't really address the aliveness, the aspect of going beyond a neutral point where there's no evidence of disease or wellness. And that's the definition of wellness that I prefer, that one that really looks at it as a growing, evolving process with no endpoint.
And a process that a special kind of process characterized by what?
Greater consciousness. The steps, I think, are first awareness, and we have a questionnaire called the Wellness Inventory to make you aware of 12 different areas of the wellness energy system, from breathing and eating and feeling and thinking and playing and working and finding meaning, transcending, communicating, all those things. Once you have the awareness, then you got to do something about it. That's the educational phase. And as you become more aware, then you can grow and change. I put those together in a thing called the illness-wellness continuum that's a diagram that's actually being reproduced widely in nursing texts and health education texts. It has a zero point in the center and an arrow going each direction to the right and the left. To the left is the illness direction with signs, symptoms, disability, and premature death. That's going from neutral in the center to bad news. And going to the right, it's, as the kid said, education or awareness, then education, then growth, and then high-level wellness is the point to which you're aiming. It isn't an end point. You'll never get there. But just to see that there are these two different directions is an important concept.
Yeah, I often, in pointing it out to people, say it's a bit like using a compass that points north, and that tell you where north is, that doesn't mean that you actually want to go to the North Pole. But it establishes a direction so that you, you know, won't go off the cliff or into the mountain, but you really hit it in the in a wellness direction. But you say that now we've medicalized it.
Yeah, the word has been co-opted by all kinds of industries. If you Google it, you know, the wellness pet food usually comes up first. And I've seen wellness colonics. I mean, it's, the word's been put together with any number of other things. And I actually used the term well medicine back in 1976. I was horrified when I realized my mistake, but that's still around. Wellness and medicine are different paradigms. The wellness paradigm is about growing and learning and questioning and being more alive. The medical paradigm or the treatment paradigm is about fixing things, and both are important. But you can't fix something that isn't broke. You have to look at what you're, where you are right now and where you want to be, but it's not something that can be fixed by someone else. It's something you become aware of as you grow and change and evolve.
And the medical industry or system is a huge amount of money that's invested in fixing things that are broken. And so the last thing in the world they want is things that aren't broken. So wellness kind of goes counter to the medical industry in a sense then, doesn't it?
Well, and it's even more the pharmaceutical industry at this point, because doctors are so controlled by the drug companies, or many of them are. And that's the where the profit margin is. So as there are many well-meaning doctors, I don't mean to say they're not, but the overall industry has been polluted by the desire to sell lots of drugs and keep people from feeling any pain.
Well, there's certainly been a huge emasculation of the medical professional. We have, you know, just judging from now, you know, comparing within the 1970s, you know, physicians have very little power over the field of medicine or over the style of their practice or whatever happens. And it does seem to be in someone else's hands, you know, whether it's pharmaceutical industries or, you know, where else? What are the other? You think that's pretty much the main driving force now?
I believe so, yeah. There's the whole focus on genes and genetic engineering and the misconception that we're controlled by our genes. Bruce Lipton, fortunately, has been putting out the concept of epigenetics, how our genes are really turned on and turned off by the environment we're in. We're not the helpless victims of our genetic code that a lot of people would see us to be. But that's not reached the masses yet. They still think that we'll find a gene for this disease and make it go away or whatever. And it's frightening, the degree of giving up responsibility people put onto genes or drugs or even in the alternative medicine field of looking for a fix from herbs, acupuncture, incantations, you name it. It's an external thing that's going to fix you rather than looking at your own inner process. And the, conceptually, there was another point I want to make of the idea of our shadow. Carl Jung championed this in the early part of the last
century. Let's come back to that right after our break. We'll take a little break and we'll come back. We'll talk about the shadow. We're here talking with the Jack Travis, or John Travis, MD, the first names in wellness. So we'll talk a little bit about Jung's shadow and how that comes into play, a little bit about the notion of understanding who we really are, and a little more about the underlying thread of connection here. You're listening to Healing Times Radio. This is Dr. Emmett Miller. And we'll be back in just a moment, so stay tuned. Hello again. This is Dr. Emmett Miller, and this is Healing Times Radio. And we're here today with John Travis, one of the first names in the field of wellness. And we were talking about a number of things, and we just begun to talk about the notion of the shadow. So why don't we just kick off with that, Jack?
Yes, I got introduced to the term actually from Michael Ventura, who wrote a book called Shadow Dancing in the USA, where he described the undercurrents of shadow in our culture. This was back in the 80s when we were doing a lot of work with culture making in partnership with helping professionals. But basically, our shadow is every part of us that we think we're not. It can be positive or negative. If you find you're very strongly attracted to someone or something, it's probably because you're not owning that same quality in yourself. So our light shadow, dark shadow, whatever it is, and we've got both, is a very important aspect of who we are. And most of the time, it's out of our awareness. So becoming aware of it, learning how we project our shadow onto other people, is one of the crucial ways of growing and taking responsibility for ourselves.
Mm-hmm. And I guess we'd gotten into that when we were, I guess you had touched on something that I also wanted to fall back on, was that the notion of that even our alternative medical practitioners fall into the same trap. Can you say a little bit more about that?
Well, I don't know that it's a trap. I was contrasting the treatment paradigm with the wellness paradigm. The treatment paradigm is very appropriate when you've got something that needs fixing, like if you're injured or have a severe infection, you know, antibiotics, that's what I would use. But when you're not in a painful place and needing fixing, the idea that something can make you better isn't always very effective. That's where the wellness paradigm comes in. With the treatment paradigm, it can be allopathic medicine, drugs, surgery, homeopathy, acupuncture, herbs, any number of ways that people can treat problems, mm-hmm. psychologically, emotionally, there's all kinds of remedial approaches. But that's different than awareness, education, growth, the undercurrent through a wellness paradigm.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And how did you connect that to the shadow?
Well, understanding your shadow is a crucial part of the awareness process. Once you own that you're more than you think you are, and this begins in infancy, Robert Bly has a great little book called The Little Book on the Human Shadow. He describes as we're born with a 360-degree consciousness, and then we're told, well, it's not okay to hit your sister. It's not okay to draw on the walls. And bit by bit, we narrow our range of possibilities down to what's acceptable, and it's different in each culture. And we throw all the rest into a bag that we drag along behind us until that bag gets so big and it's thumping and crashing around. That's our shadow. And once you learn that what's in your shadow is not as bad as you thought it was and why you're hiding from it, you shine a light on it, it clears it. So much of our shadow stuff is just our fear of looking there, not that it's really that bad. You know, what's the Winston Churchill quote about the greatest fear is fear itself or something mm-hmm. like that. It's mm-hmm. it's not the actual thing, but our fear of it that drives us to do a lot of unhealthy things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so, and of course, when we take a look at fixing, which is important on one hand, and then wellness, obviously by taking these steps of wellness, we create more balance within ourselves, and we nurture ourselves, and we deal with the energy systems of which we are a part in such a way as that we don't get the disease or the illness that then it becomes so expensive to treat. And then we get tied into that industry of fixers who mm-hmm. are now going to sell us the things. And used to tell that story of upstream and downstream. Remember that?
There's the upstream concept of, you know, fishing nearly drowning people out of the river, and they got better and better at it in the town of downstream, and so they got really good, efficient methods of hauling them out of the river and taking them to the hospital until somebody thought, why don't we go upstream and figure out why they're falling in the river? And maybe their bridge needs a guardrail on it, or whatever. It's that idea of an ounce of prevention is worth 3.7 tons of cure. I think Ben Franklin had his numbers off a little bit. And we put all of our money into cure and very little into prevention. Which brings me to my real passion of infant wellness, if we can go there for a few minutes.
Please.
That what happens to us in utero before we're born and while we're born and the first 9 months after we're born has way more impact on our later state of wellness than anything else we can do. And yet we have a billion-dollar, multi-billion-dollar industry, someone said it's a trillion-dollar industry, of wellness now trying to address issues that adults are concerned with. Most of them began, if not in utero or birth or shortly thereafter. So if we look at what human needs are, and that's what the Alliance for Transforming the Lives of Children did with our blueprint, we put 10,000 hours into basically creating the missing instruction manual, looking at what the needs are and then researching them, putting them in a very dense source document at this point. We'd love to make a coffee table book about it, but we haven't got the funding yet. It's the issues of how we experience our time in our mother's womb, what the mother's consciousness is like, because the baby is extremely sensitive. They can hear things at 16 weeks. They can sense things before that. Every motion the mother has is immediately picked up by the baby. If she's in fear, if the baby's not wanted, any number of things can lead babies to being born with a built-in fear mechanism. Mm-hmm. Then throw in hospital medicalized birth, which is an unmitigated disaster, in my opinion. It's much safer to have babies born at home. My daughter, second daughter, was born at home, underwater. We had a midwife. The natural process of birth is interfered with by the medicalization. It's like trying to go to the bathroom in front of an audience. You can't do it. And so they start intervening to make up for the unnatural situation. Any other mammal will go to a dark place by themselves, but you're in a lighted delivery room theater. And I'm just recalling your delivery room football story, Emmett, that we published. Then after the baby's born, trying to haul them off to the nursery and do all manner of unnatural things to them there instead of being on the mother's breast. Staying connected, having the cord connected until the placenta comes out, because there's another 150 mils of blood that are meant to go into the baby when the uterus is squeezing out the placenta. We clamp the cord and basically deprive the baby of 10-15% of their blood. And then we wonder why they have jaundice and all these things that are artifacts of this medicalized birth process. And then for boys, you throw in circumcision the next day, which is removing 3/4 of the most sensitive nerve endings on their body, the equivalent of all 10 fingertips in sensitivity, which causes lifelong loss that they'll never understand or recognize because they don't know what they're missing. It causes not only physical loss, but the sense of betrayal from being traumatized without anesthetic in most cases, and the anesthetics that are used aren't very effective. Then you've got a bleeding wound. Every time you pee in your diaper, it hurts like hell. And so any wonder that boys have trust issues. Then you've got the whole disconnection process of American child rearing, where you carry them around in plastic buckets, make them sleep alone. In many cases, feed them artificial baby food, antigenic substances like cow's milk or soybeans, neither of which are nearly as good as the mother's breast milk. Make them sleep alone, cry it out. All of these things are just immensely inhumane, and I call it normative abuse because it's the norm, but still abusive. And this leads to the chronic disconnection that is rampant in our culture, leads to violence, addiction, depression, chronic illness, fundamentalism, religious extremism, materialism, ecocide, we're destroying the planet, and the one I mentioned earlier, male postpartum abandonment syndrome, which is especially the case for men when they become fathers. And I'll launch into that for a minute if it's okay. I mean, are we do that?
Sure.
The prof- profound disconnection that I think is across the board in Western culture is worse for men because they grow up looking for the mommy they never had. They find her, marry her if they're lucky, and they think everything's okay until she has a baby. And while she's had similar wounding, she has a physical connection with the baby from carrying it in her body and then nursing it that we men can never experience. So she begins to heal that wound and to bond in a way with this huge hormonal cocktail that their bodies cook up, ideally during birth, but that's interfered with also by medicalized birth. There's this love potion that happens, the oxytocin and prolactin, that are designed to bond the baby and the mother to an inseparable unit. And the guys get all of their wounding re-stimulated by watching this. They're not conscious of it usually. And the pain is so great that they begin to withdraw. And I know this from personal experience, both of my daughters. The first one, I was completely unconscious of it. We eventually separated when she was 2.5, the most painful experience of my life. But I wasn't ready to be a father then, and it was that or divorce, and in my family you didn't get divorced in the 70s. So I went through this process, this pain, firsthand, and that's how I learned about it, of the profound re-stimulation of this early disconnection that I thought I had healed by finding a wife and bonding. So men leave emotionally, as my dad did, or physically, as I did. And the statistics are enormous. We can't find good numbers on them, but just in the wellness movement, the four pioneers of the wellness movement all were separated from their children by our early childhood. And then the founder of it, Halbert Dunn, I only recently discovered he left his family when they were about 8 or 10. I tracked down his granddaughter, and we didn't even know he had kids. It wasn't mentioned. So this is a rampant issue that goes back to the core of the wellness movement, but I don't think it's just limited to that. I mean, Emmett, you personally have had this similar experience you may want to share about. It's profound, and it affects our entire culture. But it's not the man's fault. It's not the woman's fault. It's the culture where we've destroyed the village, the extended family, the tribe, the method through which kids are supposed to be raised. A nuclear family, if it takes 4.9 adults per infant to adequately meet their needs, do the math. A nuclear family isn't going to cut it, particularly if they have more than one kid. And so you're in an impossible situation trying to probably hold down two jobs and raise a kid that was designed to be raised in a village in a with lots of arms to carry them around and lots of older kids to take care of the younger kids instead of carting them off to daycare. It's a crazy, crazy situation, and we accept it as normal, and that's why I call it normative abuse.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Got me going there, huh?
Really? So, how can people get more information about that? I mean, I think that I'll bet most of our listeners, their heads are just nodding up and down saying, yeah. Now what? How do we get our foreskins back? How do we get our foreskins back?
Oh, well, there is actually a very good method of restoration. It takes a year and a half, to recover the glands of the foreskin, of the penis, with stretching skin, but you'll never get the nerve endings back. There's quite an improvement, I'm told. It's a big commitment. I've thought about doing it, and I've never...
Interesting.
Had the wherewithal to actually go through all the work. But once the glands becomes an internal organ again, it becomes a lot more sensitive. Yet it's the least sensitive part of the penis. This is what Masters and Johnson misled us all 40-some years ago in human sexual response.
Yeah,
they said, and they were correct, that there was no difference in the sensitivity between the glands of a circumcised and intact man. But that's not what you test.
Right.
90% of the nerve endings are in the foreskin, and if you cut them off, it's actually 75% of them are there. if you cut them off, you can't test them in the guy that doesn't have them. And they didn't know enough to test them in the guys that did, because they just seemed like a flap of skin that's just covering the glands. But that's where the nerve endings are.
Well, when I said how do we get our foreskins back, I was actually speaking metaphorically. How do we?
Oh well, you got the.
What can
got
we
more than you bargained for, huh?
Or less, but just it. I mean, you know, given that we have a world where there has been this massive disconnection, how can we learn more about it? How can we respond to the damage that's been created, and how can we avoid creating it for our children and grandchildren?
Well, understanding the basis of what we call connection parenting, and that's on the atlc.org website. Pam Leo has been one of the pioneers of that. She's one of our co-founders with her book, Connection Parenting, which is focusing on how to heal a lot of the wounding that occurred if you didn't do attachment parenting, which is focused mainly on the first 2 years. There's Attachment Parenting International, the work of William and Martha Sears, who've published a number of books, from the baby book that we used with my second daughter, who was the result of my reading the Continuum concept, Jean Liedloff's wonderful book that describes how it's possible to be in a culture. All of those things that we can do if you're having babies or your children are having grandchildren for you, there are ways that you can prevent it in the next generation. How do you fix it in this generation? There's all manner of ways of becoming more conscious, more aware, all the wellness techniques. They can help. They certainly can't replace what was lost, but the better you learn to compensate for what your losses are and find the gift in your wound, and that's what my professional life has been about. So all those things.
Wonderful. Well, all too soon we've come to the end of our hour. We've been talking with John Travis, wellness specialist, if I might use a sort of oxymoron, who is the author of the Wellness Inventory Online, which you can find at wellpeople.com. Also look up thewellspring.com, which is where you'll see the wellness workbook, and you'll be able to follow up on many of the things that we've talked about. And for those of you who have a little extra disposable income out there, why don't you support him in getting his book published, Why Men Leave, The Epidemic of Disappearing Dads. And if you email him from his website, thewellspring.com, he'll give you a link where you can at least read the magazine article where he began to talk about it. Thanks so much for being here, Jack.
Great fun, Emmett, as always. Thank you.
And we'll have to do it again. Bye-bye. So, that's it for today. You've been listening to Healing Times Radio. This is Dr. Emmett Miller. We'll be back soon, and until then, stay tuned.
You've been listening to Dr. Emmett Miller's Healing Times Radio, Conversations with Extraordinary People on Dream Vision 7 Radio Network. For more information about Dr. Miller's work, his upcoming events, new programs, and how you can change your mind and change your life, visit his multimedia website at drmiller.com. That's drmiller.com. If you would like to take advantage of Dr. Miller's 20% discount on all of his MP3 guided imagery programs, visit shopdrmiller.com, locate your desired program, and use the promo code DREAM, all lowercase, when checking out. Conversations with Extraordinary People is produced in the drmiller.com studios. Special thanks to Jesse Churchill and Deborah Beauvais.